of other countries, but the United States is arguably the most powerful nation in the world, and Israel is the most powerful nation in the Middle East and Southwest Asia, and they have single-handedly shown that, you know, the UN Charter, the Fourth Geneva Convention, the international covenants are just a set of empty shells. And it's astonishing to see what's going on, like in the West Bank, for example. This may not be your own specific purview, but there is no rule of law. It's the law of the jungle.
To some extent, that is what we are witnessing. I mean, all these international institutions and international instruments were created precisely to tame the power of some states who behave in an irresponsible manner. Because there was no need to create a reasonable international system of human rights if we trust the democratic processes and rule of law at the domestic level. Because the history has shown us that whenever there are concentrations of power, that becomes perhaps a license to behave in an irresponsible manner. And of course, U.S. is not as powerful a country at this point of time as it used to be, because we are moving towards a multipolar world. But definitely, U.S. is still a very powerful country. It has a veto power in the Security Council. And like many other countries, I will suggest that it has misused its veto power, and it has condoned very egregious and serious violations of human rights law, as well as international humanitarian law in Gaza and West Bank in the old Palestine. And this has been going on for a while. These are very sacrosanct principles of international law, whether this is respecting the territorial integrity or issues about self-determination or equal sovereignty of states. Or serious human rights challenges that are reflected in relation to crimes against humanity, genocide, war crimes, you know. So basically, all of these core values, it seems, are under attack. And rule of law is definitely failing in those particular situations, because it is the powerful that who are able to run the show, unfortunately.
Now, of course, the Trump administration would say this is none of your business. We're just trying to make America great again. Where do all you special UN experts, human rights experts, and special rapporteurs get off, you know, telling us what to do? You know, it's none of your business. What would you say to that?
I mean, definitely, every country would like to become great. There's nothing wrong with that. So if this current administration would like to make the U.S. great again, we have nothing, no quarrels with that. That could be a good goal for the country. But our difficulty is with the process and the tools and the approaches that are being used. So if U.S. is, let us say, an insular place, it is not connected with any of the rest of the countries, then U.S. cannot survive, in my view. Even if it is a powerful country, U.S. is absolutely dependent on many things. No country at this particular point of time can survive in a globalized and multipolar world alone. International cooperation is absolutely vital. For instance, if all other states completely block any export of anything to the U.S., what will be the implication for the U.S. economy? Of course, it will definitely hurt the economy of other countries. Similarly, what we see is that in relation to trade, all the member states created WTO. There's a system in place in terms of that. But what we witness is that tariff is used as a terror. So I will call it tariff terror.
Tariff terror.
Yeah. And I think that is being used as a tool to create a hegemony of a country which is not in line with the international norms and standards, whether it's about trade or human rights. So we definitely believe that we have a role to play. We are appointed by a Human Rights Council, and even U.S. Used to be part of that council. Of course, the current administration would like to withdraw from it, but it doesn't really change anything that we are created, established, and appointed by states collectively, and we are given a mandate to objectively assess the human rights situation all over the world. And that is precisely what we are doing.
Now, one of your most powerful paragraphs in this February 27th statement deals with what's going on actually domestically in the United States, talking about regressive actions, active undermining of respect for human rights within the U.S., and undermining elimination of DEI, equality, inclusion, diversity, equity, and inclusion provisions in U.S. public policy. Can you talk about this?
I mean, we see that there is a false dichotomy created between the meritocracy and this idea that somehow DEI policies are inconsistent with meritocracy. Because what is merit? Merit is based on a number of variables. So if a school child is experiencing some disadvantage because of economic, political, cultural situation. So let us say a child is studying at a school in Gaza. On the other hand, there's a child studying at an elite school in New York. If you ask these two children to compete without creating any affirmative action provisions, that is not meritocracy. That is substantive inequality. Even within the US, historically, we had situations, historical injustices and inequalities. And to overcome those, affirmative action provisions are very much part of the US constitutional jurisprudence. So this idea that diversity, equality, inclusion, all these are the values which are foreign to the US legal system, or they are somehow undermining meritocracy is completely unacceptable and is not sound in our view. And I think that is our concern. And it's not merely that, we see a pattern. So we can see this in relation to gender equality. In fact, we have not commented specifically on the US Supreme Court, but if you look at the recent decisions of the US Supreme Court, and some of these judges were appointed by the this current president in his previous term. So we see a pattern that these systemic attempts are basically to undermine all the progress that we have made in relation to gender equality. And on the whole issue of migrants, for instance, I mean, US, like any other country, is a country in which there are a lot of migrants, and they have played a significant role in the robustness of the country, whether it's military or education or science or innovation. If we do an analysis of who are the top brains, let us say, in terms of the US economy, the data is likely to indicate that this is going to be a very diverse group of people, and some of these are migrants. So this idea that somehow migrants are something we should exclude from the national process and economy, of course, every country has a right to decide in terms of migration policies, and we are not denying that prerogative of US or any other country for that matter. But what we are quite worried is that this negative image is created of migrants and the concept of migration as such, which is highly problematic, and treating those in very inhumane manner is also very problematic.
And you also speak in this paragraph about threats to journalists, students, freedom of expression, more generally speaking, in the United States. And a corporate capture of the U.S. government. What do you mean by that?
I mean, these are two, in a way, distinct issues, but not unrelated. So in terms of the threats to freedom, because U.S. has always taken pride in terms of freedom of expression, freedom of speech and assembly and all those things. And in recent years, including the current administration, we see that those values are coming under attack, especially in relation to pro-Palestine protests at universities and otherwise. We noticed and we monitored those situations that sometimes it was very repressive attitude and those protests were not allowed. So I think that is problematic from our perspective. The second issue is the corporate capture, as you mentioned. What we witness here is that corporate capture as a concept refers to a phenomena in which businesses are basically controlling the government decision-making processes without any checks and balances. And those corporate actors are trying to achieve their own goals and interests, and they frame it as if they are trying to help the country or society. So I will not name the names, but it is very clear that this current administration is deeply entrenched by big multinationals, big US corporations, and some of those decisions are driven by that. For instance, the whole idea of laying off the employees of the US government is driven by that idea, right? And I think that's where the due process is not followed. That is where checks and balances are not followed. And we have to keep in mind that all of these business enterprises have an independent responsibility to respect human rights, the environment, and they have to take measures to mitigate and against climate change. So instead of doing that, they are in collision with the government in a way and trying to undermine the whole process, whether it's about human rights or the environment. And climate change again is a serious concern because US government is withdrawing from the Paris Agreement, and this idea drill baby drill is repugnant to where the countries together should be going.
Was David Kattenberg's Green Planet Monitor. Find the archives at greenplanetmonitor.net, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Harbinger Executive Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. Since 2016, Stefan Christoph's Free City Radio has been exploring the intersection of social activism and the arts in Montreal and beyond, like on this highlight from a recent episode featuring Immigrant Workers Center organizer and Essential Work Disposable Workers, Migration, Capitalism, and Class author Mustafa Henaway, in a conversation exploring the ways that opposing policies of war abroad are connected with local struggles against racism at home. Now, here's Stefan.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. This is edition 257. And on the broadcast today, I'm going to be sharing a conversation that I had with a community organizer in Montreal, Mustafa Hanawi. This conversation looks critically at the ways that there is a connection between contemporary policies around militarization and war and the years directly preceding 9/11. The connection is made here between the local and the global, looking at how migration policy is affected by war. I think this is a very important connection to make, and I'm really happy to share this conversation with community organizer Mustafa Hanawi, who works with the Immigrant Workers Center in Montreal. I think that importantly, this conversation looks at the ways that we continually in thinking about the importance of community organizing can always seek out ways to connect the local and the global. So it's a pleasure to share Mustafa's perspectives and ideas here on Free City Radio, and I will let the conversation speak for itself. So here's my exchange with community organizer Mustafa Hanoui that was recorded on the streets in Montreal in Park Extension. So here it is.
We're in Park Extension right now in Montreal, and I'm sitting with Mustafa Hanoui, who is a community organizer at the Immigrant Workers Center and has been doing a lot of meaningful support work for different migrant communities, both around their working rights as workers, but also around supporting them in their struggle for status. So this is a huge moment right now for the Status for All movement. One element I was hoping maybe just to first talk to you about is understanding how speaking about status and like people's asks, demands for justice in terms of having their status is connected to things that are happening internationally. So just like sharing a bit with people around how, you know, what's reported, you know, in relation to war or displacement is part of understanding the picture of non-status workers, because that connection isn't usually made. So maybe you could first start by introducing yourself.
So my name is Mustafa Hanoui. I'm an organizer at the Immigrant Workers Center. I'm also a writer, and I've been active in migrant justice movements for over two decades now. And whether it be with taxi drivers in Toronto and the OCAP Immigration Committee, and then here at the Immigrant Workers Center.
OCAP is?
The Ontario Coalition Against Poverty.
Okay. So any thoughts about this sort of connection between the local and global? Because I also remember a lot of people were talking about that in the context of the years after 9/11, in the context of war, and war is definitely a reality right now also.
Well, I think then the connection was actually quite stronger, because a lot of, after 9/11, a lot of the immigration restrictions, increased border controls, the militarization of borders, and the communities affected were a direct result of the sort of the racist backlash, anti-Muslim, anti-Arab, racism and xenophobia that was inscribed in law in the days, months, and years after 9/11, right? That this was a very much a front in the war on terrorism, right? And what that meant was sort of the restriction on Muslim migrants, the sort of the connections to what was the securitization of people's refugee claims, whether they were coming from Palestine or were Palestinian refugees, whether they were coming from Algeria, and or whether they were Pakistani men like Operation Threadbare, who were caught up in a web of RCMP and CSIS operations that led to their deportation on the grounds that they were that they were terrorists, right, or suspected of terrorism or accused of terrorism. So there was actually much more of a connection of what was taking place in sort of the unjust wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, but also this was the time of the Second Intifada in Palestine. And so there was always much more of a connection about the global issues and the local issues in terms of immigration. Now, unfortunately, we see less of that connection. And I think this is a problem, because a lot of the debates we have around migration now, there's always this us and them, that we're being invaded by hordes of migrants, that these are simply economic migrants, that they are causing a crisis of our cost of living, or causing a crisis around our housing, that our house is too full. You know, recently, the racism by Trump and the false narrative of Haitians eating animals in Springfield, Ohio. But there's never a discussion of how Haiti, as a failed state, was a project of the U.S. The through structural adjustment, coup d'etats backed by the U.S., that Haiti is no longer livable because of U.S. foreign policy. There's not that discussion when we're talking about why Haitians are moving here and what our responsibility is. There's no discussion around Palestinian refugees and our role in their displacement and continued displacement, because without a Palestinian state and without the right of return, Palestinians are forced to live in exile in the camps in Lebanon or in Jordan or in Syria.
Refugee camps.
So the fact that there's no discussion about the role of Canadian and U.S. foreign policy, economic, politically, militarily, then you don't actually have an accurate description of why we're seeing waves of migration, who is coming, and why are people coming. So, for example, if you look at the largest, you know, we now live in the moment where there are more refugees since World War II. And the vast bulk of those refugees are a direct result of Western political projects in the global south. So if we're talking about Afghanistan, Iraqi refugees, Palestinian refugees, which make up the bulk, South Sudan as well now, and also countries like in Venezuela, right? So in terms of the destabilization and the sanctions on Venezuela, regardless of what our perception is of Maduro and what that process is that the U.S. shouldn't be intervening there and shouldn't be sanctioning them. And as a result of that, now we're seeing some of the largest waves of refugees coming across the Darien Strait are Haitians and Venezuelans. So there's no description, there's no discussion about the role we play in creating this mass destabilization. And our policy is no different than 9/11. Maybe the logic is the public discourse is quite different. Maybe the 9/11, or in the days after 9/11, in certain contexts. Now, I mean, in Germany, you have sort of the temporary ending again of the Schengen rules. So in terms of Germany just put up border controls all along its borders when that is not what it's allowed to do under the EU, under certain exceptions, but because of the far right, and also there had been you know, an incident where a refugee claimant had, you know, gone to the Israeli consulate in Munich. So, I mean, again, there's this context. We're not talking about German foreign policy, German military support for Israeli apartheid, in causing this mass destabilization across the region, whether it be Syria, whether it be Yemen, whether it be the economic policies in Egypt in terms of structural adjustment and propping up the Sisi regime. You know, Egyptians now make up the largest number of irregular migrants to Europe. And all of that is because we're supporting a military state through the IMF, through the World Bank, through Gulf capital, to maintain its power while it impoverishes its own citizens, to ensure that it is a gatekeeper for U.S. foreign policy alongside Israel in the region. So, but we don't have that discussion. We just have migrants from the global south who are invaders and who are taking our jobs and taking our resources and our public services. We don't have a real discussion. So, I mean, in terms of the links are there, but I, unfortunately, in the public discourse, we don't see it as it, it's actually, it's just, it's completely missing, whether it be from the left or the right.
I recall there being very striking debates in the organizing spaces when people were organizing towards protests against the invasion of Iraq. And there was debates because some people wanted to have the voices of asylum seekers that were facing deportation to the regions impacted by war speak at the rally as part of our understanding of the effects of war. I'm just wondering if you have any reflections on that sort of discussion and how it's connected to this present moment.
Well, I mean, there'd always been that attempt. I mean, so if you even go back a bit further than the anti-war protests, sort of in the anti-globalization movement in 2000, 2001, even during 9/11, or like the protests, let's say at the World Economic Forum, or the G8 meetings in Alberta that took place, even though there was this, there was an attempt to push, say, we have to talk about racism, we have to talk about xenophobia, we have to talk about war, but we have to talk about asylum seekers and refugees as part of an anti-racist and anti-war discourse, that this is a different front in the same struggle against war. And this is how we're going to concretely connect to those communities and actually mobilize with them and support them. Unfortunately, there were some sections of the left that was too radical. We need to focus simply on anti-occupation, that it's disconnected from local politics. And I think that can have a very disturbing effect in terms of not just in the movement, but actually more broadly, right? And so, for example, when we wanted to talk about and it was very much connected to even Canada's role, right? When many people wanted to talk about not just ending the war, but ending the occupation, or talking about Canada's role in global imperialism. No, we just simply have to talk about the U.S. invasion. We have to talk about ending the invasion, anti-war. Anything else is too radical and will take away from the movement. But actually, by taking away those elements and those discussions, we actually took away from the movement, right? And the movement wasn't able to sustain itself after the war began, because we weren't having those discussions within the broader anti-war movement prior to the invasion. And so I think that's also an important lesson that could be learned, right? When if maybe we were talking about all of these things then, would our political landscape be different now? When thinking about the genocide in Gaza, thinking about what's taking place in the region, if we were talking and also the anti-migrant politics now, if we were connecting those things 20 years ago in a broad way, the political landscape could have been different now.
That's a highlight from a recent episode of Free City Radio. Find it wherever you get your podcasts and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You've been listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. This episode's been brought to you by Unrigged. Learn more about Canada's coalition of 27 progressive publishers and get all your progressive news, videos, and podcasts in one place at unrigged.ca. Follow us on Twitter at Harbinger Tweets and on Instagram at Media Harbinger and now Blue Sky for updates on new episodes. And subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for a weekly Wednesday roundup from Canada's cross-country community of 80 socially and politically progressive podcasts. We'll see you back here next week for a new episode. Until then, I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
This is Thurston. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby. Yeah, keep listening.
Communication is everywhere, but what is it? Communication is how you share your thoughts, your opinions, your culture, from what you see on TV to what you post online. But what about the people who are not being seen or heard? AMI is a media company that strives to be a voice for Canadians with disabilities, whether it's through positive portrayal, reflection, and accessible media. AMI believes everyone should be included, and that includes you. AMI is inclusion. Experience AMI at amiplus.ca.
Hey, do you want to make a real impact in the Black community? Join us where we connect you with Black-led organizations from all around the world. Get ready to get involved. Find the organization based on the location of interest. Follow us at supportblackcharities.org.